Our reading this morning is taken from the book of Mark, chapter 14. Mark chapter 14, we'll be reading from verses 32 to 42. In the Pew Bible, it is page 1083. And they went to a place called Gethsemane. And he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." And he took with him Peter and James and John and began to be greatly distressed and troubled. And he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch." And going a little further, he fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." And he came and found them sleeping, and he said to Peter, "Simon, are you asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." And again he went away and prayed, saying the same words. And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy, and they did not know what to answer him. And he came the third time and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and taking your rest? It is enough. The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." This is the word of God.
As we go through the Gospel of Mark, last week we just finished up chapter 4, and all of a sudden now today we're in chapter 14. Why the jump of 10 chapters? It's very simple to explain. Since Easter is in 2 weeks, I thought we're going to go through all of Mark anyway and come to the crucifixion and the resurrection of Christ. Since it's Easter, why don't we just jump ahead? Take a look at a few of the passages. Well, they're on our minds and the whole event is on our minds. So this week and next week, we're going to look at some aspects from chapter 14. And then after Easter, we will go back and pick up where we left off, starting with chapter 5. Waiting for certain events can be rather dreadful. Time filled with great anxiety and even fear. I remember in 2008, I had just spent 12 months working very hard, completing chapter 3, about 60 pages of my thesis of a proposed 5 chapters. And the data of chapter 3 revealed something that I thought might kill my thesis on interfaith worship. I took a deep breath, and I contacted my thesis advisor, and I waited for his reply. And while I waited for his reply, I felt sick. It was like I had the flu. I couldn't sleep. I had no appetite. I would stare at my bowl of shreddies in the morning without any desire to eat them. And you know, when you let your shreddies stay in the milk too long, they get really soggy and get even more disgusting, so I don't even want to eat them at all. And during those days of intense anxiety and waiting for an answer, is this it? Is my thesis dead? Do I have to start all over again? I've spent a year, hundreds, literally hundreds of hours in research and work. And am I going to have to start all over again? And I wrestled with it, and I did have an option. I thought, should I just quit? If the answer is, yeah, it kills your thesis, should I just quit? In that program, I could go back into the non-thesis option. Or should I persevere and stick with it and start again from scratch? So as I wrestled with that, I did say to God, I made my decision. I said, Lord, you gave me the opportunity to do a thesis. Even if I have to start all over again, I will. And then I think the next day, my thesis advisor called me back and he says, no, that doesn't kill your findings, and the data does not kill your thesis. This is sometimes what happens, but you got to document it exhaustively. And then you still have two more chapters, which also are going to bring another good, helpful perspective and answer the question of your thesis as well from different perspectives. Whatever the event that you're anticipating, be it a job loss, potential firing or layoff, a biopsy report that might be cancerous, waiting for news from your spouse's workplace where there's been an explosion and you have no news on them. The wait prior to the event or prior to the news coming can be extremely intense, where we fluctuate between hope and despair, where we pray for the best but prepare for the worst. Gethsemane, it's Jesus' time of dreadful waiting. Gethsemane means olive press. It was located outside of Jerusalem on the Mount of Olives. The Gospel of John describes it as a garden. The language that is used of Jesus going in and out suggests it's a walled garden. It's a private place. He probably has gotten permission from the owner to go there. He goes there often, the Gospels tell us, with his disciples. I'd like you to flip back to Mark chapter 10. Keep your bookmark in Mark 14, but just go back to Mark 10 and look at verses 33 and 34. As they're going up to Jerusalem, this is what Jesus says in Mark 10, 33 to 34. See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and will deliver him over to the Gentiles. And they will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise. You see, when Jesus enters Gethsemane here at this point in the text in Mark 14, these things that he just had told his disciples earlier that's going to happen to him, they're moments away from beginning to happen. In a very short time, he's going to start to experience these things. At that moment, simultaneously, while he's taking the disciples to Gethsemane, Judas the betrayer is arranging, coordinating the arrest party, and are on their way. Jesus is very close to the hour in which he is going to be delivered up, and all these things are going to actually happen to him. He's actually going to experience what he said. Jesus, who is used to being in charge, Jesus, who is used to going and doing things for others, now Jesus, in this moment of waiting, has to become passive. He has to become submissive. He has to become silent. He has to allow others to lead him like a lamb, according to their desires, according to their ways. He has to allow them to lead him in wrath to slaughter. And he knows all this, and he knows more. After separating Peter, James, and John from the others and going to another part of the garden with those three, verses 33 and 35 of chapter 14 reveal to us that Jesus becomes greatly distressed. So much so, he says, my soul is troubled to death. It's overwhelmed to death, sorrowful to death, and he falls to the ground. All this language, posturing, indicates extreme anguish, extreme agitation. Numerous psalms have the same kind of language that mirror the emotion, the thoughts of Jesus and his state. An example of Psalm 55, verse 1 to 6, contains these phrases: "Give ear to my prayer, O God, and hide not yourself from my plea for mercy. Attend to me and answer me. I'm restless in my complaint, and I moan. My heart is in anguish within me. The terrors of death have fallen upon me. Fear and trembling come upon me, and horror overwhelms me." So much so, as I said, he fell to the ground. Jews didn't usually pray on the ground. They prayed standing up. Unless they're overwhelmed in soul and mind. You know the other passage in Luke 22, verse 24, where it talks about his sweat. He's so agitated, so laboring here in prayer. The sweat comes off him like blood. It's like he's been cut. The sweat just pouring out of him. The point in this period of waiting is that Jesus is facing the full realization of what it means to submit to the Father's will. You see, it's one thing to talk about how you're going to die. And he did, and he prophesied it, and he depicted it, and stated it clearly to his disciples. But it's a whole other thing once you start to experience it, when you actually have to go through it. I mean, some of you may be able to have an inkling of that. You know, it's one thing to talk about chemotherapy and radiation, but it's a whole other thing to go through it. So Jesus is at the point here in the garden where he's moments away from being handed over, and he's going to actually start to experience all these things. And so the weight of that has come down upon him, the realization of that. Many people have faced death calmly, but his death is unique. It's different. And so he prays, "If it's possible, Father, let this cup go from me." The reference to the cup in the scriptures in a lot of places, the dominant reference to cup that comes from God refers to a judgment. God's judgment of wrath upon sin and sinners. It's his justice. And there's a contrast with this use of the cup. So usually a host will give a cup of refreshing liquid to their guest. And it solidifies the relationship. It brings refreshment to the guest and prompts the building of a relationship. But this cup doesn't represent that. It represents God giving sinners their destruction and saying, "Drink and die." And in chapter 10, verse 45 of the Gospel of Mark, Jesus said, "He came to give his life as a ransom for many." But to give his life as a ransom for many, he's got to drink the sinner's cup. The cup that God gives to the sinner, the cup of God that is the cup of wrath, the cup of justice, the cup of punishment. And he's going to drink this cup as an innocent, pure son of God. He has no sin of his own. And he's going to drink it as the Son of God who has, from eternity past, enjoyed nothing but perfect fellowship with God the Father. All he is known in his relationship with God the Father is goodness and joy and blessing. But he's going to now identify with sinners so fully by taking upon their sin upon himself. He's going to become the object of the Father's wrath, the Father's judgment and justice against sin, being, Isaiah said, crushed for our transgressions. And this realization overwhelms him in the garden. So he prays, if it is possible, remove this cup from me. This prayer of his, of asking for the removal of the cup, tells us a couple things, or informs us of a couple things. Number one, it tells us he genuinely struggled in his humanity to embrace the will of God the Father in order to save sinners in this way. Yeah, Jesus is and was the pre-existent Son of God. Jesus is God, fully God. He's divine, always existed. But he took on, as he came into this world voluntarily, he took on a human nature and a human body and joined that to his person so that he is fully God and fully human. And in his humanity, he struggled with the weight and the experience of bearing sin and the justice and the wrath of God against sin. And so, in his humanity, he reveals he would prefer another way. If it's possible, I'd prefer another way. And the second thing about this is that the request, as he asks this, as he prays this way, it's not to be understood as an act of rebellion or insurrection. It's actually still an expression of trust. As it says there in verse 35, he fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but you will. David Garland notes that this request of Jesus in the context is expressing trust in the sovereignty and the omnipotence or the all-powerfulness of God. So he says, all things are possible for you, Father. So he's asking God, Father, in the context of your great power and all the things that can you do, is there not another way? Is there another way we can bring many to salvation? I'd rather do the other way. But not my will, yours. Joel Green notes, if Jesus is going to bypass suffering and death, it will be because God introduces an alternative route for the realization of his purpose. So Jesus prays this way several times, it tells us, but he gets no answer. The answer, if there is an answer, is no. You shall suffer this way. This is the way that I want to save humanity. So Jesus battles off the temptation. He battles off and wrestles through this intense time, battles off the temptation to evade the cup by fleeing off into the darkness, or by taking things into his own hand and not submitting to the will of the Father. He surrenders and submits through prayer. And thus he becomes ready to do the will of the Father, fully submissive, fully ready, at peace at the end, ready to do the will of the Father and to die, to be betrayed, to be handed over, beaten, flogged, crucified, etc. Now Jesus, if you notice in the text, I'm sure you picked it up, Jesus is not the only one to face temptation, the struggle of wills. Whose will be done? Jesus isn't the only one who faced the weakness or the limits of humanity. Just prior to going to the Mount of Olives, In chapter 14, verse 17, Jesus said this to his disciples, "You will all fall away, for it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered.'" So he's quoting from Zechariah. And the reference is Jesus saying, "I, the shepherd, am going to be struck. You, the sheep, are going to be scattered." So he's warning them of danger to come. Again, if we look in the parallel accounts, Luke chapter 22, verse 31 to 32, Jesus revealed to the disciples that Satan has asked to sift them like wheat. The "you" in the plural there, when it says Satan is asked to sift you, is plural. So he's referring to all the disciples, not just to Peter in that text. So there's, again, great danger here. They've already been told they're all going to fall away. One is already betraying him in the process. Another, before this text, before Jesus prays, he's already told Peter, "You're going to deny me three times. Satan's asked to sift you like wheat. What other danger's coming?" Reaching Gethsemane, he takes the three apart, Peter, James, and John, three who had affirmed, like the rest, "We'll go with you all the way to death. We'll die with you." And he tells them three times, "Watch and pray. Watch and pray." Three times he tells them that. "So that you do not enter temptation." But alas, you know the story. They can't keep their eyes open. They'd rather sleep. They are asleep both physically and spiritually to the danger that they are in. David Garland writes, and I quote, "Jesus knows that he will not be delivered from the cup, but will be delivered into the hands of sinners. He has freely accepted God's will for himself, and through prayer has steeled himself for what lies ahead. By contrast, the disciples have squandered the opportunity for prayer by sleeping." End of quote. So in this period of intense and acute waiting, Jesus prays fervently, intensely, and that is how he surrenders his will and keeps it in check, so that he comes up and he stands at the end and says, "Yeah, the betrayer's coming. I'm going to do the Father's will." This is how he is prepared. Not so the disciples. They sleep. On the next slide, you're going to see a picture from the results of Pearl Harbor. You know, and the surprise attack of the Japanese on the U.S. Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor, December 7, 1941. Killed over 2,400 people, injured over 1,100, and destroyed or damaged 19 U.S. warships and 328 Army or Navy aircraft. Technically, the Japanese had not yet declared war. They had intended to by that point, but the message didn't get through. Fact was, whether the Japanese had declared war or not, the U.S. was caught sleeping. The few hints of a possible attack earlier that year were ignored. That very day, when a radar operator said to his superior, "Look, I got a group of planes coming towards us," his superior said, "Must be bombers from the American mainland. Nothing to worry about." Gordon Prange wrote an exhaustive book on Pearl Harbor. I've not read it. It's over 300 and something pages. I skimmed a little bit on Amazon. But he entitled it with a great title, fitting title. It's called "At Dawn We Slept: The Untold Story of Pearl Harbor." In Canada, we have been raised in the last decades in a secular, humanistic, cultural, political, and educational system. It disbelieves in any spirit or existence of an immaterial spirit. So whether that's God or angels, or the human spirit, or demons. Those things are written off as imagination, non-existent fairy tales. Evil, sin, and demons are explained away as illnesses, illusions, and environmental conditioning, or genetic conditioning. Guilt is a bygone carryover from ages past. It's not necessary or real. Same with sin, same with evil. We're enlightened people now. We don't believe in such things. Problem is that even as Christians, having grown up in this culture, in these educational and political and cultural systems, we too have unconsciously and even consciously bought into some of this. We bought into some of the humanistic nonsense, so we sleep. We, the church, sleeps. Will you watch and pray? Do you remember the pattern that Jesus taught his disciples to pray? Remember specifically what Matthew 6:13 says? Do you have Matthew 6:13 as the content of your prayer? When was the last time that the content of Matthew 6:13 was part of your prayer or part a regular part of your prayer? I hear the pages turning. I know some of you are looking up Matthew 6:13. Good. It says, "Lead us not into temptation, deliver us from evil." When was the last time that you or I, or together as a church, we seriously asked God, "Deliver me from temptation. Protect me from the evil one. Protect me from the devil." And I don't mean just a quick reference, "Oh God, protect me from the devil." But I mean some serious intercession where you implore God, "God, protect me from pride and hate and lust and unfaithfulness and greed and revenge. Enable me to overcome selfishness and self-righteousness and money-loving and unforgiveness and fear and anxiety and faithfulness and ungodly philosophies of this age and false doctrine that's in the church and idolatry." When was the last time you wrestled with God over these issues? In prayer, saying, "Save me, protect me from these things. Don't let me fall into these temptations." We need to be in earnest prayer for the defense against the Christian's three enemies. The one that's within, the flesh or the sin nature. The one that rises up, the response of hate and bitterness and revenge that rises up when we're wounded by somebody else. Oh, there's a great temptation right there. All kinds. The stuff that rises up from within in terms of selfishness and greed, aggravated by materialism and the false American dream. That you are just to be happy, wealthy, and prosperous. That gets into the world, the second enemy, the whole way of organizing life apart from God. The system of living life without God, that's the world. And then you have the devil and his demons and evil spirits. I don't advocate that there's a demon behind every problem in our life. Of course not. A number of our problems are our own fault and our own doing. But that doesn't mean there are not demonic temptations and aggravations and opportunities that come our way. Why would Jesus tell us, lead us not into temptation, deliver us from evil? Why would he? I mean, he takes, this is serious. This isn't a nice, cute prayer that people are say mindlessly, our Father who art in heaven. That's the problem with repeating the Lord's Prayer all the time, is because you say it mindlessly. It becomes irrelevant. Jesus didn't mean the prayer to be said word for word, mindlessly. He meant take the theme of the content and then use your own words. So what is he saying to us when he says, pray that you may not be led into temptation, that God may protect you? Why would he say that? Why? Well, let's take a brief and quick look at it. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8. Why would he tell us to pray that we be protected? Why would he say, lead us not into temptation? 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8. Be sober-minded. Be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. And then you flip over to Ephesians chapter 6, verses 11 and 12. Ephesians 6, 11 to 12. Put on the whole armor of God, that you might be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. And verse 13, therefore take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand firm. We've been told we're at war. The church isn't a club. The church isn't about making you happy. This isn't a happiness club where you are to come and to feel good. There are lots of clubs out there that can do that for you momentarily. The church is about being God's people and about knowing God. And we, as his people, are at war. We're soldiers. We have enemies that want us dead, deceived, and useless for the kingdom of God. Ignoring the devil does not make him go away. In fact, if you ignore the devil, you've already lost. He's got you. You're already asleep. Are you a civilian or are you a soldier? Every Christian's supposed to be a soldier. Are you asleep or are you awake? We're all to be awake. Watch and pray. Heed the warning of Jesus. Watch and pray. I close with James 4, verse 7. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Can't resist the devil if you don't submit. In our times, as we wait, watch and pray. Submit to God as Jesus did. Then we'll be able to stand.